Well, it is a great pleasure this week to interview Chris Scotter. And Chris, you're at the Open University and you live just outside Edinburgh. And also, of course, I feel a little not intimidated, but very aware that you have far more experience of doing podcasts than I do. I think you were one of the trailblazers well before I started my nostalgia podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I don't do too much of that anymore. The Good Ship Religious Studies Project is safely in the hands of other managing editors. But yeah, back in 2012, myself and David Robertson, who is currently an OU colleague, but we were colleagues at Edinburgh at the time. Yeah, we started that to try and be a religious studies podcast. There really weren't any at the time. And I mean, we're well past 400 episodes now, but you know, you're creeping up on us.
I know, I've done 170 odd of them, and yeah. I'm aware that's a good number, but I started in 2018. So you actually, to be fair to you, in 2012, to be doing I'm not sure I even knew what a podcast was in 2012.
Yeah, the landscape's quite different now. But there were a few that I was listening to. Kermode and Mayo's film review, as I'm sure you're familiar with. Although I haven't enjoyed their shift to Kermode and Mayo's take. I don't know what it is. That used to be the one that I religiously, there's a good word for us, listen to every week. But since they went sort of corporate, it's drifted off, and I've now got months of unlistened episodes. I don't know quite what it was, but yeah, there were a couple around, and we just thought there was a gap in the market. We aimed to do 10 episodes with sort of people who are visiting the University of Edinburgh RS seminar series, and we thought we could use those as a captive audience. And then it just spiraled with a BASR conference, which I'm sure will come up because that's where we met at a BASR conference. Everyone there was like, a podcast, fantastic, we'll speak to you. And it turns out that academics want to talk about their research, right? Yeah. who would have thought? And it's been a really kind of easy thing to do because people have written stuff and you're not asking them to do any extra work. You're just saying, come and talk to me about that stuff that you've written. Yeah. And I think it worked to provide some nice accessible ways into topics for people. And I still use it a lot when I'm told, you know, you need to write some content about this. I'm like, I know nothing about that, but I think I did a podcast about that 7 years ago. So let's dive back in.
Absolutely. And I found that what I did with my podcast, or I'm still doing, is kind of similar to that. But for me, I'd be going to people's papers and think, okay, so you've had like a grant, you've had maybe teaching buyout, so we haven't seen you for 12 months, and they're presenting their research, and you're thinking, this is wonderful. But I'm thinking, why are you doing this? As in, what was the, you know, we're talking about impact, but what's the impact on you? Because for me, that's always the way, it's like a good radio program as well, that if you kind of feel that you know where the presenter's coming from, if you engage with them, you want to listen more. So if somebody says, look at all the wonderful work I'm doing, I'm like, well, you know, I'm not going to be persuaded by stats. You can give me all the figures you want. I want to know why you're doing this. I want to know the personal journey. And I realized that's what I was always interested in. So of course, you know, I write articles and books and go to papers and write papers and do all the sort of conferences, all the sort of stuff that we have to do in this profession. But I always thought, I want to know why the person is doing this, why they've chosen that path. So it became almost sort of a podcast that wasn't, tell me about your second monograph. It was, tell me, if anything, why you wanted to write that monograph and maybe what were the things that inspired you to do it and maybe also the things that impeded you from doing it. And so it's use the word impact, but turned it into the self, you know, the whole turn to the self, subjective turn thing that I think my nostalgia podcast is kind of predicated on. So it was sort of using that, but trying to work out why somebody does what they do, what makes them get up in the morning and do the work that they're doing. And then that way, I found that I'm much more inclined to want to read their stuff because I'm like, ah, now I know the motivation, or you actually never intended to write that in the first place. There was always something, some other project or indeed career that you expected to have. So for me, it's been an interesting journey of trying to almost like peel away the different layers of the onion.
Excellent.
So tell me a little bit about your own way into this, because obviously you're working for the Open University at the moment. You're obviously somebody who's been doing work in the study of religion for many, many years. But tell me a little bit, first of all, about the academic journey that you've been on.
the academic journey I've been on, right? This could fill the whole hour. So the first thing to say is I'm from just outside Belfast, which you probably can't quite pick up in the accent. It's a little bit there. I moved over to Edinburgh in 2004 to do a degree in physics, which always surprises people a little bit. Now, why physics? Well, I never enjoyed anything at school, but I could do everything at school. I did very well throughout all straight A's and A levels and all that. I ended up with A levels in physics, maths, further maths, and information technology, which seemed like rational choices at the time. I think I was thinking about lucrative careers in banking or engineering or something along those lines, but I didn't enjoy it. I just was like, school was a thing you had to do. And I'm always good with deadlines, and you know, if there's a bar that you've been set, I'll try and get to that bar. But in my last few years of high school, I discovered amateur dramatics, which I'm sure you'll be aware of is another thing that I do. And I had a real shift in those last couple of years, suddenly going and getting into the school choirs, like in the elite school choir, having never really done any singing before. I was in a band. I was voluntarily buying and watching Shakespeare and reading Shakespeare. And suddenly in my last 2 years at school, I was in about five or six different musicals in various capacities. And I was like, I have made all the wrong decisions here. I'm about to go and do a degree in physics, and I should have been studying English and music and history and drama. Why have I done this? So I made the decision to go to Edinburgh. It was the only open day I didn't go to. I went to all the other open days, didn't like the unis, and then thought Edinburgh has the festival fringe, so I'll get to do some artsy stuff alongside doing this boring physics stuff. So I came over to Edinburgh, and since I've been over in Scotland, I think I'm now approaching 50 different theatre productions that I've been in since. Got to Edinburgh, suddenly went from being top of the class to getting 50% in stuff, really struggling along the sort of boundary between C, D, not enjoying it. I was working hard, but I didn't care. I didn't want to work hard, and I'd never really had to work hard before. So after the first year, it became, I'm going to drop out. But my director of studies was a very kind person. I was like, well, you shouldn't drop out. You can withdraw from your studies, take a bit of time, work out what you want to do, and then you can come back next year and pick it up again, and all will be well. And that sort of appeased my parents as well, who'd, you know, ploughed a lot of money into me moving over to Edinburgh. And in the intervening time, I looked at other things I could do. And the three subjects that were jumping out at me were psychology, sociology, and religious studies, as things that I just found interesting. I think it was like, how do people work? I want to understand people. I could do these things. I could be interested in that. And I landed on religious studies. Again, perhaps a little bit of parental appeasement there. My father is a Church of Ireland minister, which actually only fully started when I left Northern Ireland. But I think I probably thought that'll be an easier sell if I'm going to go and study religion. And because I was already part of the University of Edinburgh system, I didn't have to reapply. I just transferred over and started in first year again after that year out. So I don't know if I had any real right to be there. I had no qualifications that would have led me to be there. And I just loved it from the start. I think because I'd had those 2 years, that I was like 2 years older than most of my peers, I knuckled down and worked a bit harder. I'd got that sort of initial university blowout out of the way. Yes, I'd never really written an essay before, but I bought some books on how to write essays, and I treated it in my methodical sort of science trained way of, right, this is what you do. You get these quotations and you string them together and you build your argument from A to B to C and you support it with evidence and blah blah. And I started to do very well. And I think it was about when I started. So in Scotland, we do a it's a 4-year honours degree. So you've got your third and fourth year are your honors years. But by the time I got to my third year, I said, I want to be doing what these guys at the front of the lecture theatre are doing. And lo and behold, I've managed that. In terms of what I do in the study of religion, I mean, lots of my colleagues would say, oh, I do the method and theory thing. I also position myself within the critical religion strand, largely because of exposure to folk like Russell McCutcheon and Tim Fitzgerald and stuff whilst I was at Edinburgh, because there was quite that critical emphasis. But it was there was a random we had Professor Susanna Heschel came over from Dartmouth for a semester on exchange, I think the course was called The Jew in the Text. I couldn't really tell you too much about it. We read lots of ancient and modern Jewish texts, but she was a fantastic teacher, and because she wasn't from Edinburgh, like she did think, like she had our course group around her flat for dinner one night, just invited us all around and had us around for dinner. She bought us pizza during one lecture, and just really engaged with us in a way that the other staff did not. And she was participating in a round table on the new atheism one evening at New College at Edinburgh. And I didn't know what that meant, but I thought, Susanna is participating, so I'm going to go along to it. And they were talking about Richard Dawkins and these folk who I'd not quite heard of at that point, but that sparked a this kind of there's these sciencey people who are talking about religion that chimed with my sciencey background. And personally, I was on a sort of journey from vague theism through a teenage period of quite committed stuff to abandoning that. And I was like, I would like to spend time reading this stuff. Now I've had my fill of new atheist literature, but that sort of started me on that path. And then I wrote my dissertation on the new atheism and then plowed on to a master's looking at non-religious students at the University of Edinburgh, and then expanded that into the PhD to do an ethnography of non-engagement with religion in the area of Edinburgh in which I live. And I've done a variety of other things on top of that, but that's kind of the journey that got me
And
here.
it's an amazing one, because I just you just reminded me of a PhD and also undergraduate student of mine who I interviewed actually a couple of years ago, who did all sciences at A level. And interestingly, her father is a priest in the Church of England, and I think there was some element of resistance, like she was not gonna go down the same sort of path. But I think her father, though he was a priest, didn't have a background in religious studies. It might be something like more geography sort of related. And then at the last minute, she decided that she actually wanted to do religious studies or a variation on that anyway at university. So despite having a background entirely in science, she did religious studies here at Kent, and then was sort of somebody who was navigating so many different sort of terrain. And it's that interdisciplinary background and the set of interests being far wider than anything that she might have expected to be doing at school. Sounds very similar to what you're saying. It's interesting that you could easily have had a path based on what you were telling me. You could be an eminent physicist and all the rest of it, and all that, but actually it wasn't the right path for you. And and how interesting that, I look back at people I went to school with. In some cases, I was never the straight A's person. I did well, but not, there were people who were like, destined for Oxford and all the rest of it. And they were getting, if they did 8 A levels, they would have got all A's, and then some of them maybe they didn't do 8, but they did 3 or 4 or possibly a few others. And I always find it interesting that we always end up in places that we wouldn't have imagined at the age of 17 or 18. And so I love all of those reunion type things when we all sit and talk and say, actually, do you know what? The person who had that future mapped out, did the complete opposite, and is floundering in a different way, not in a bad way, but not in the way that they would have expected. And then there's me, who, you know, sort of like went through this sort of like very kind of like, you know, interesting route of going to a church school, doing theology at university, still working in that sector, but have lots of other things that I have always been desperate to do. But I didn't ever imagine that I'd be doing a degree in theology. And yet that was the path I took. And I've kind of stayed doing the same sort of thing, often teaching the same things I was taught 30 years ago, yet doing the media type stuff, which I always wanted to do, but doing it within the subject area made my theology background into something, or teaching stuff that I could never do at university 30 years ago. So it sounds in some ways quite a similar journey.
Yeah. And just mentioning Oxbridge, like, I think one of the greatest blessings in my life will have been, I had an interview at Keble College, Oxford, to do physics, and I didn't get in. And I'm very glad that I did not get in, because if I struggled with the physics at Edinburgh, I imagine I would very much have struggled in an Oxbridge environment, and wouldn't, I think, have had the same opportunities to be flexible and pivot in the way that I did, and wouldn't have had all the artsy stuff around me at the same time as well.
Yeah, so. And some of the people I know, a school friend of mine who's a great sort of like, well, actually, he's an astrophysicist, and he does all this amateur dramatic stuff. I know it's something I'm sure we'll get on to talk about shortly in your own case, but it's so funny, the number of people I know who've got very clear backgrounds in science. Almost, you know, it's the word counterpoint that we always need. And so, you know, if their background is in science, they have to do something artsy almost, you know, in order to sort of compensate for that. And you find it in so many ways that it's almost like the academic, you know, our students know us for our academic journeys and the books and all the stuff that we do, but there's so much more. And maybe social media often sort of gives a clue as to that, which my own professors and, you know, people who taught me 30 years ago didn't have. Just seeing them in the supermarket was weird enough. It's like that person who just taught me on Bultmann, you know, in the lecture yesterday, is shopping for baked beans or sausages in the supermarket. It's like, no, you know, you can't imagine that they would do real world things.
And, never.
You know, and I'm the guy who goes to the cinema every night, you know, and I think, what do my students think of that? Actually, I think they love it, or they find it weird because they don't go to the cinema. They're like, why do you go to the cinema? We just watch Netflix. So again, the sort of things, you know, it doesn't fit. I, you know, 30 years ago, students would go to the cinema. Now they don't go to the cinema, but I do. And yet I didn't go to the cinema before going to university. So it's funny how things move in those sort of ways. It's almost like we're playing a constant game of catch-up with a former version of ourselves.
I can get that.
Interested, so you were talking obviously about growing up in Northern Ireland. Do you want to say a little bit about what it was like to grow up in Northern Ireland at that time? Because I'm guessing you're talking about the period around maybe the 90s?
Yeah. So, well, and it's interesting. I've also attempted to reconnect with my Leverhulme project, which is still needing a lot of work to get written up, but I did a comparative study of unbelief in Scotland and Northern Ireland because I wanted to bring that autobiographical stuff in and force myself to get a bit more acquainted with my own roots, as it were. I've now got lots of books on the shelves behind me about Ireland and Northern Ireland that would not have been there if I hadn't done that. I mean, I had quite a privileged upbringing, I suppose, quite a middle class family, which makes a lot of difference, I would say, in those contexts. I'd say middle class, like neither of my parents would have come from middle class backgrounds, but they've very much, you know, worked hard and have established that life for themselves. So like the first 8 years of my life, I grew up in a Protestant household, let's put it that way, but would not describe it as particularly loyalist. So I know those Venn diagrams often cross over in a Northern Irish context. Now, I say not particularly, you know, my parents are, you know, they like the royals, and but they tend to vote for the Alliance Party. And since my recent involvement with the Scottish Green Party, they've now started also, you know, it's interesting when you start to see that loop feeding back, and they're like, oh, we voted for the Greens in the local election and stuff. I'm like, go parents. But they're they very much stood apart from a lot of that inter-community strife. And so the first 8 years we were in a bungalow and not in the countryside, but it was on a sort of country road. So we didn't have, there were no real neighbors or anything. There was no calling it a loyalist or a nationalist area. It was just a house on a street. And then we moved to a new build estate when I was 8 years old. My folks stayed there till I left. That was in Newton Abbey, which is a sort of suburb of Belfast, just to the north. Like the buildings don't stop from the centre of Belfast right out to Newton Abbey, and you can walk in to the centre of Belfast in about an hour and a half, as we did sometimes as teenagers. And within Jordanstown in Newton Abbey, and it was quite, again, a middle class area of relatively new build estates. And our cul-de-sac that we were in, I would describe it as, you could say, out of the 20, 24 houses, you go around the cul-de-sac and go Protestant, Catholic, Protestant, Catholic, Protestant, Catholic, right the way around, which was really nice. And it was quite an integrated cul-de-sac because it was new. So everyone there was new. And so there was a good community spirit. And we had the millennium happened within a few years of us moving there. And then that brought the whole cul-de-sac together, and they started to do a new year party every year and community fireworks and have a Christmas tree in the cul-de-sac and all these sorts of things. But I would say everyone still knew where everyone was positioned within that Protestant Catholic dichotomy. So it was still important information to have, and you still, you know, the kids from one side went to certain schools and from the other side went to other schools, and so you would see it in the names of the schools and the school buses that people got on and so on. But then also just up the road over the railway bridge went into Monkstown, which was where if you wanted to go on a walk to the shop you had to go over to Monkstown. And then suddenly you were into a loyalist heartland with red, white and blue curbstones and flags everywhere, and every June, July, shops getting burnt out, cars getting burnt out. And if we walked to those shops, you had to be careful not to call certain of your friends by their real names because they were Irish names, and that sort of thing, just in case it drew the wrong sort of attention. So we were very close to these sorts of things, but blessedly distanced at the same time. Like, I wouldn't say I had ever really experienced much in the way of sectarianism, but you knew there were areas that you didn't go to. Like, you know, my parents had a very different experience of it. My mum was, you know, there was an IRA bomb that blew out the windows of a house that she was staying in and stuff. And I do remember getting stopped by the police to open the boot of the car on various occasions, and roadblocks getting in the way of us getting back from wherever we'd been because some incident was happening. And I remember the border guards and the big watchtowers at the Northern Ireland Republic border and that sort of thing. So I think it was a time of transition. The Good Friday Agreement happened during my living memory and so on. So it, but I still feel when I go over to visit, and I've brought friends over who've never visited Northern Ireland before and so on, they have a great time. But everyone reports there's just that, there's still an undercurrent of suspicion. Like, just people need to know where to place you. And I still don't think that's quite gone away, even though things are a lot better in that regard. And, you know, Belfast particularly is largely just like any other European city, relatively faceless with a few bits of history. But then as you spread out just from that center, there are still areas that are very clearly tribally aligned and so on.
I wonder in my case, because I went to a church school in Wales, and yet we didn't really talk about religion. It was one of those things where the school, often lip service was paid. So we'd do we'd have school assemblies, and we'd say grace at the end of the day. We'd do all those sort of things, very much on rote. But I did religious studies at A level. I was one of just a handful of other students, and yet it was one of those sort of elephants in the room. And that's probably what made me do theology at university, because and the complete opposite actually to your experience, because there everyone knew you were Protestant or Catholic, and there were issues. You know, you had to be careful how to navigate that sometimes. In my case, it was sort of like I'd go to church, I'd go to a church school, but I genuinely almost had no idea what religion was in that sense, because it was something that was there, but I couldn't access it.
Yeah, ubiquity sort of breeds, well, a sort of indifference, not indifference, but, you know, like if it's just there, it doesn't ever get called into question. But just a final thing on the sort of growing up Northern Ireland thing. When I moved over to Scotland, suddenly I became known as Irish Chris. Chris, is, as you know, is a very common name, especially when you move to universities. How do people differentiate all the different Chris's? So quite quickly, I was Irish Chris in the halls, in the student flats and so on. And I got into rugby, watching rugby, pub watching rugby. And my motivation was very much the pub. And then people were going to the pub to watch the rugby. So I went, and Ireland were good at rugby and still are very good at rugby. So now I'm avid fan. So I started to support Ireland in various things. I celebrated St. Patrick's Day, which I had never done when I lived in Ireland. So it's one of those things that through removing myself from that context, I've been able to sort of claim that area of my identity now. And so there's a couple of facets to that, right? So first of all, I wasn't able in that Northern Irish context to claim Irishness because of my particular community background. Irish was a problem, you know, like you were British. So being Irish wasn't, and again, this wasn't that there was a big pressure from my parents or whatever, but it never seemed like something I could claim. It wasn't my community or whatever. So being over here allowed me to suddenly claim and engage with and be part of a sort of pan-Irish identity, as it were. But then also, I think within the Northern Irish context, I had always reacted quite negatively, as you would imagine, to the whole sectarian thing. So the idea of identifying with really anything in that regard was somewhat anathema. I saw people who identified as loyalists or nationalists as part of the problem. They were the issue. So when I was there, I didn't want to have any kind of national identity, I suppose, but moving out of that context then allowed me to feel proud of that part of me that wouldn't have been able to have expression beforehand. And then we'll maybe get onto this, but that sort of bled over into, obviously, in a Scottish context, there was brewing Scottish nationalism, and I reacted quite negatively towards that when I moved over here, I think because of a lot of baggage that I brought with me from a Northern Irish context. And I remember being very kind of anti Scottish nationalism because I saw it in the same lens of being, you know, it's just stoking up hatred, and it's why not just be happy with the status quo? It's working, there's nothing to be, you know, what's your problem? And then it had quite a shift in that regard, not for national identity reasons, but I suppose because my politics were shifting as I became more politically conscious to the left and to be more socialist. And it started as I learned more, probably through my studies and just exposure to different people, that happens when you move to a vibrant cosmopolitan city. And you know, I became more conscious of a lot of the negative things that I would say that the UK stands for, and a lot of the negative things about the UK as a state. And I had a real switch, a light bulb moment where I went, you know, actually, I don't like the UK. Now, that's not saying anything about the people of the UK, and so, or even the different nations, but it's the institution and its history and what it stood for. And sort of I flipped and got quite on board with the nationalist cause in a Scottish context. Not because I'm like, yeah, Scotland, freedom, but because I see it as a chance to disrupt a problematic state that still exerts far too much power because of a colonial history, and perhaps at least have the opportunity to set something up afresh and new that might at least have more potential to be, have more equality and be more democratic and so on. And so I quite a shift in that regard, but that was, I think, very much because of that Northern Irish baggage that I brought with me, that I was quite resistant to just the word nationalism, to the idea of waving flags. And while I'm still very like, this probably chimes with your research, symbols and traditions and all that, I can be quite resistant to enforced settings where one is meant to do certain things with certain symbols. And again, I think, and flags carry a quite negative baggage for me. I think that a lot of that's due to that history.
Absolutely. And I always find that, particularly around like football championships and so on, and people are waving the English flag. Now, people often think that I'm English, and I'm certainly not, but I get very kind of worked up, and anything to do with flags in any sort of context for me carries a sort of a jingoistic meaning, but also I suppose in the context of like football, quite a negative side, because it's almost the sort of the identity politics of, you know, you're on this side or you're on the other side, and in so many respects I neither want to identify with the people on the side that I'm ostensibly on, but also I kind of don't like the whole idea it's us and them. I've always had a problem with binaries. You used the word dichotomy earlier, and I suppose that whole religion, just secular thing, probably got me into the study of religion. But I agree with you, because I when I was last up in Scotland a few years ago, you know, very aware of the whole, you know, the question around independence is very live. But Scotland has a very clear and rich and beautiful kind of identity. And there's a part of me that perhaps my younger self, particularly in the days when you'd have like conservative government ministers, secretaries of state, who'd make all the decisions for Scotland. Now you've obviously got a parliament that does those sort of things. But you know, in those days, there was that sense of separation was a bad thing, because if you separate, then that means to say you're moving away from this sort of wonderful homogenous entity. Although ironically, when it came to Brexit, I was very clear that I wanted to stay, right? Because so sort of like, you know, you can be pro-independence but anti Brexit, but pro Brexit. No, other way around. You know, anti Brexit. So I'm aware of all those sort of different things, but that is kind of the point, I think. And exactly. I always find that, you know, it's like with religion, you know this, when, you know, people talk about religion, they often, and philosophers who I work with, wonderful people, but they often sort of see religion as something that is not remotely what I see it as and what I teach, because they think religion equals God. So if you come up with a logical reasoning sort of approach to sort of dismantling Aquinas, or, you know, let's subvert the cosmological argument or something, let's prove it wrong, that somehow therefore we've proven that you can get away and do away with religion. And I sort of look at it and I think, I just said to my students this morning, shopping is a religion, film is a religion. How does that fit with 13th century principles? And of course, for them, that's what religion is. Religion equals God. And I think, how funny, because I talk about the death of God with my students, but I'm not sure the last time we talked about God in the way that you are. So that's why I have a problem. I see flags and I immediately see something that actually doesn't in any way fit with any sort of worldview with which I'm comfortable.
Exactly. These are the sorts of things that I love now in an analytical sense. And one of the working definitions of what I do would be like, I study these things, these appeals to tradition, or these us and them binaries, anything where something, you could use the word sacred if you wanted, but where something is invoked that is in some way inviolable or doesn't have a necessarily a rational basis to it, where something just feels right, or oh, this is right because any of these locations are things where I feel are absolutely ripe for religious studies inflected research, and we as people do this in all sorts of areas. You know, it's just thing, it's how humans are. I think, you know, you find your groups and you navigate the world, and there are some things that you can't quite put into words, but that are just, you know, lines that you won't cross, or things that feel important to you. Anything like that, I'll go, I can analyze that. I'm not saying it is religion. I'm saying what happens if you put the religion word in and look at it in that way. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of crossovers there.
Yeah. But I'm back to what we were saying a moment ago about the way that sometimes you work in one area, there has to be that counterpoint, almost that sort of something to reset the balance. Where and in your case, obviously, so the physics background, you moved into a very sort of humanities based sort of subject area, but maybe actually brought a very bespoke lens, you know, to what you were doing, because you came with a different sort of parameters to any of the other students or indeed tutors maybe in your your studies. But I'm interested in all the AmDram stuff as well, because that's something I always enjoy, because that's why I also knew that you'd be such a wonderful person to talk to for this podcast, because I see all of that on social media, and also the film stuff, which I'm obviously would be keen to talk about as well. Do you want to say a bit about that? Because how did you get into AmDram? And it sounds like that is as much a defining thing about of what you are as all the academic stuff.
I would say it is. And interestingly, I worked up a research proposal to look at the I'll say the religious dimensions of the AmDram scene in Edinburgh. Religious dimensions is a problematic phrasing, but that would still be something I'd like to do. So yeah, like I got into it in the last couple of years of school, and the school did a Gilbert and Sullivan production that you could only be in if you were in the sixth form, so lower sixth and upper sixth, as it was in our context. And for some reason, it was really cool to be in the Gilbert and Sullivan. I don't know if it's an urban myth or not, but it apparently, when a former headmaster instituted this Gilbert and Sullivan, he said that anyone who was on the first 15 rugby team had to be in it, otherwise they'd be off the team. And I think that, if it is true, set up a thing whereby it was the cool thing to be in. So I went along to audition for that, not because I wanted to do it, although I'd been seeing the productions every year since joining the school, and I'd always found them quite fun, but I went along because everyone else went along, and I got into the Pirates of Penzance in the chorus as a bass, and just thoroughly enjoyed the process. I wouldn't know how to at the time to put it into words, but thoroughly enjoyed it. And on the back of that, the music teacher was standing beside me at a rehearsal and was like, "You've got a really good voice. Do you want to join the chamber choir?" And I did that, and suddenly found all this stuff that I'd not had before. And within a few months, there was another group in Belfast was doing the Pirates of Penzance at the Waterfront Hall, like a sort of adult group, but they were looking for a few more people to bolster the cast, and so I went and did it again a few months later in a different context of different people, and that started me in that journey. I've done a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan, probably because it was my comfort zone because of what I started out in. I've been trying of late to extricate myself from that because it becomes a bit of a habit of you know, I got into at uni, I did GNS, and then there's the Edinburgh Gilbert and Sullivan Society. I've had several lead roles with, and it's sort of the easy thing. And there are only 14 shows that they ever did, and I've done 11 of them, and some of them multiple times, and played the same part. And you know, life's too short to keep doing the same thing over and over. And also, I know that with GNS, I can go back to that in my 60s and still do it. So I've done quite a few plays, and I've done grand opera and operetta, and I'm trying at the moment to do more musical theatre, which is a different ballpark. But people would often describe, say, if they're looking at sports and religion, they'd be like, "Oh, there's this great feeling of, you know, communitas that you get amongst the fans, and this big feeling of togetherness, and following the team is like, it's a devotion that's similar to to religion and so on. But as we've just been saying, with that, there's always an us-them dynamic in sports, no matter what. Even if it's individual, there's people that you're competing against. Whereas maybe some listeners have been to like a music festival or something, and I would find at a music festival or just a gig from a band that you are really into, I find I get that same feeling of communitas, but without the oppositional nature. Like you're all there sharing an experience, and you don't know who the people are around you. You don't know where they've come from, what their politics are, what their religion is, what their sports teams are, but in that moment you're all there with a shared purpose, and everyone gets on, chats, and at festivals you get it because you get days of interacting with people, and you're all in this weird zone. So I find with doing shows, you get that similar, like, yes, it's probably slightly more classist in terms, in terms of the spectrum of people who'll participate in it, because you do have to have a certain amount of resource and spare time to participate. But you do have people from all walks of life, all different persuasions, and you're doing this thing. There's an end product. Like it's a defined period of time, and there's an end product, and you're on a stage. That feeling, and sometimes like the rehearsal process, which can it can be weeks or it can be months, it can become a bit of a drag. It can be a bit grueling, and sometimes you're like, oh, I've got rehearsal tonight. But when you get to that week of doing the show, you go into this other world of like, usually take time off work and just completely get into that zone. Everyone who's involved suddenly becomes your best intimate pal. And when it finishes, there's this real, you might have heard the phrase, the post-show blues. Like there's a real dip of like, my life has no meaning anymore. Where are these people that I was surrounded with doing this thing? And it's just there's no feeling like it, I find, for like just coming together and doing that thing. And the other side of it then is, I think that people that do artsy stuff like that tend to be, like wear their emotions on their sleeve and form connections quite readily in a way. I'm not the most sociable person. I don't, we're talking well here and that's great, but I'm quite shy. And you wouldn't think that I would want to put myself on a stage and doing stuff, but it's the whole thing. You're not being yourself. So it allows that outlet, but then also just that coming together of people and that building connections, I find it is a way that certainly helps me forge connections and be authentic in a way that I'm quite reserved and standoffish in day-to-day life.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because was on the occasions that I've met you, and you did a live sort of radio equivalent type program, which you chaired at the last BASR, a British Association for the Study of Religion conference in 2019. And you're very witty, you're very droll, you're very good, and you had four people on the team, and and it was all playing off against each other. But I find what you're saying really insightful because. So I've just gone from saying that I have, and I think we agree on this, that we have problems with binaries sometimes, and yet I would, some people, people would say you are you an extrovert or an introvert? And sometimes I think, well, you can be both. And somebody said to me at work about a year ago, they said, Chris, they said, thinking about it, I think you're an extrovert, but maybe a shy one, like an introverted one. And I thought that actually is a nice label to have because it suddenly explains, some situations I'll be quite socially awkward and always have been and would always like be way too shy, knowing I wanted to do something like the radio sort of type stuff that I guess this podcast is, and I'm good at or I enjoy teaching, but I can be very nervous in many social situations. But I think it's back to that word counterpoint that sometimes it's like that there's something that we there's a gap somewhere, and we have to find the right bespoke way to fill it. And so sometimes if you're quite a shy person, going all the way and doing something on stage is actually it's a very dramatic way, literally, of doing it. But if you're going to compensate, it's kind of all or nothing. And then you can retreat back into perhaps something that's a bit more sort of comforting. But you always need that kick. So, you know, you kind of need something that is the polar opposite of what you're normally doing in order to reset the boundary. So that sort of overcompensation mode that I find, you know, at times when institutions in our sector are going through some awful changes at the moment, that sometimes, you know, some people will feel very awful and want to give up and very toxic. And I sometimes think, okay, the only way to cope with this, to stop from being brought down, is to overcompensate in other areas and explore opportunities, because otherwise you're just going to let this thing destroy you. So actually, what you said there, I think completely makes sense. And it probably means that, you know, it might surprise people who think, I didn't know Chris could do those sort of things, or he's a shy person and he's doing all this stuff on stage. But you probably sort of realize that is your authentic way of expressing yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I don't form new connections easily. Like, put me in a party or something where I don't know people, and I will not interact very well. But when I have, I maintain those connections and I keep those. And when I feel safe in a group, then I am myself or whatever. So I think doing all this stuff is a way of kind of fast tracking that, you know, like you put yourself in that at the start of the rehearsal process. No, but then, you know, suddenly, oh, now I've built up this new group of people that I don't have to to be reserved around and so on. So.
Yeah, and that's a good seg, because I want to say something about film, because often you do comment very, very kindly on you know, when I put all these sort of film reviews up sometimes, and the Entrapment actually is one that comes to mind, because that happened to be one I think that I commented on once, and I related just to what you were saying, because I'm somebody who'll go to public spaces, I'll go to the cinema. And that's my, you know, it's almost like if I've been in work all day, going to the cinema of an evening is kind of a necessary antidote in some way. But I go on my own as a solitary person to a very public space, and I engage in a public space, but on my own. But then I have this utter need to have to disseminate what I'm doing with my virtual community of friends on Facebook. Yeah. Now, all of those things, that all these paradoxes, you know, people at the cinema who don't know about the reviews and they don't really know what I do in a day job probably think, you know, this guy always comes on his own. He comes like every night sort of thing, and he watches a film and he leaves on his own. And yet, of course, people who know me in work see a very different side to me. So I'm aware that there are all these sort of paradoxes and people who don't really know the joined up Chris, and they just see the sort of the partial Chris. But I guess on Facebook, I sort of then need to overcompensate and say, hey, I've just seen this film on my own. And I need to tell you about how amazing it was. Whereas if I was to go with 20 people, I probably wouldn't need to share that on a social media context, because I'd have the audience with me. So, but film plays a big role, I think, for you as well.
I would say it does. And it's interesting, you know, so my fiance is very differently inclined in that she would say, you know, the idea of going to the theater or the cinema on her own, it is anathema. You know, it's like, you know, I'll be judged or whatever. And it's a way, I always think, well, apart from, you know, the theater in the interval and the cinema, well, not at the interval anymore, you know, like you're not interacting with the people that you've gone with anyway. And you're having your own experience. Like, yes, there is that, you know, a film is affected by the others in the room with you. Your experience is totally affected, but it's a personal thing. And I do enjoy showing movies that are important to me. I'll show, you know, like showing them to people and like seeing their experience of them. I do enjoy watching things with others, but I'm very much a fan of, you know, I'll go to the theater or the cinema on my own, and I've got a list of movies that I'm like, well, no one else is going to want to watch these with me necessarily. They're too artsy or whatever. But every time I get a moment, I'm like, I'm going to watch that and enjoy that. Yeah, so I think there's nothing wrong at all with having that solitary enjoyment. But then, yeah, it provides, if you can really get into it, it's such an, they can be a real emotional experience in whatever capacity. And then they contextualize things that happen for years to come after. You've got that emotional memory to refer back to. You refer to it in conversations with others. You talk about it. So it's a social enterprise, even if it's a solitary pursuit at the time. And I know I very rarely, I do occasionally post little pithy reviews of things, but not to the extent that you do. But yeah, there's that thing about sharing, you know, having your own experience, and you'll have your own experience whether you're sitting beside someone or not, but then sharing it afterwards.
Absolutely. And actually going with somebody else can be difficult, because I've been in situations where you go along with somebody and you spend the whole time thinking, oh no, they're going to hate this. And I've been in situations, I did actually go to the cinema once to see if something, and it was actually a Paul Verhoeven film. And it was a pretty, let's put it, it warranted its 18 rating, let's put it that way. And the person, I thought, she's going to want to walk out. And I was thinking, I was fascinated by the film, and I knew that there was so much I was going to get out of it, but I was aware that somebody was very, very uncomfortable watching this. And part of me just kind of thought, no, because if I watch this on my own, I can write a review and people can choose or not to engage with it. But actually you're sitting there with somebody, and so my apprehension of the film could not be disentangled from the fact that I was with somebody who was physically awkward. And I just thought is almost like watching this reluctantly. And that's probably a valuable lesson, that if I'm committed to something, it's like if you're working on a book or doing, if you're working on an essay or working on sort of project, you might need a community of people to help you steer that, but you can't write it with them. You have to physically write it on your own. And I think that if we're really passionate about something, committed to something, sure, like going to a football match, I can imagine doing that with a crowd, that I can see the obvious benefits of doing that. But if I'm going to go to watch a film to offer some sort of, you know, to write, I don't just go to a film so I can write a review of it, but that is the outcome of it. I think I'd really struggle doing that with other people. And I've been to films when you have like Creed 3, I think I saw recently, when lots of men in hoodies all like going en masse to this. And it was quite an interesting environment, and I remember thinking, I'm here on my own, everyone else is here in large groups, and it was a very sort of masculine presence and people were throwing things and it was a bit disruptive, and I just thought, no, it's interesting. So that, you know, that for me changed the way I understood that the nature of cinema going, because normally it is just me, you know, often it is just me in the, you know, with a handful of other people. So I think we have to find our own way of navigating.
Exactly. And you know, I was just thinking there about some of my most intense experiences watching film, and they actually haven't been in the cinema. They've been, there's quite a few are linked to train journeys. If I've brought me, I remember when I saw The Road for the first time, and it's one of my top, you know, if I had to say what a top five movie was, I mean, it is. I saw it on a train, not really knowing anything about it, but just and I've now seen it lots of times, and it just affected me quite deeply. And similarly, I think one of the most recent I watched was the Father, the Anthony Hopkins. I watched that on a train as well, going to something work related, but just like, right, I'm putting the work away, let's watch one of these movies I've been wanting to watch for a while. And you can have just such an intensely personal engagement with it. And there can be something about being in that, I'm in a public space here, but I'm in my own thing with my screen and my headphones and enjoying that. But then also one of my favorite pursuits, and I've not been able to do it much, and particularly now with parental life, sapping finances and time and whatnot, but I'm so lucky to have the Edinburgh International Film Festival just beside me, although that's, I believe, it might be struggling at the moment because of the film house going out of business and whatnot. But one of my favorite things to do was to just take a day, usually it would be a Saturday, and just, I'm going to go to the film festival today with no plans about what I'm going to see, other than looking at the schedule and working out how many movies I can see in that day, and go, okay, if I do these four, I can see four, or maybe I could get five in if we do those five, and then making that my reasoning, I'm going to go and see these five films, know nothing about them, see them on my own. I might say to someone, I'm going to be here, here, and here at these times if you want to come and join me, but just making it my thing. And you can, especially at a film festival, you can get some very interesting things. But everything that I've seen has been enjoyable in some way, shape, or form, because you've got no idea what you're getting in for. And
That sounds like my experience of Sundance, and it was sort of like, there's just, you know, you can't see everything. Actually, that's almost worse. I've been to academic conferences as well. When you travel literally like to the, well, San Diego comes to mind for the AAR in 2007, and it's like wonderful to be there, but then you can't go to everything. And you think, I've traveled literally halfway or more around the world, and actually I can only see a handful of the things that are here, you know, almost just like, why, you know, and then you'll spend more time trying to juggle. Can I get from this venue to that venue, or do I have to leave this one early? But in the end, you know, I thought, well, I may only be able to see two, at most three films a day, which sounds a lot, but obviously if you're in a film festival environment, then you know, you could see more than that, but actually it would probably get to the point where you're not able to sort of engage with it in a meaningful way, and actually there's a huge amount to benefit from doing that, because you're slightly out of your comfort zone, but you kind of know that you're watching things that you may never ever have the chance to watch again, and it's sort of like, catch it now, that the chance is not going to come up. And you know, I'll often be sitting in a multiplex watching kind of reluctantly a Marvel film and thinking, this is showing in every cinema in the land, multiple screenings in the day, and I'm just thinking, this does nothing to me, and I pine for those Sundance experiences.
I think my favorite experience is, like, you know, I'm a big Darren Aronofsky fanboy, for example. I've still not seen The Whale yet, and it's on my list, because I can get it through a streaming service at the moment. But experiencing a movie, usually on my own, something in a Darren Aronofsky sort of ilk, watching it and going, I've had a really intense experience, and I enjoyed it, but I couldn't put into words, I couldn't analyze the film, I couldn't really, you know, say why I enjoyed it. And then just knowing, like, I've just had, there was something about that experience that I really enjoyed. I just loved being in the zone and feeling those things and trying to work out what was going on. And sometimes at the end of the movie, I'm still like, I have no idea what was going on. And then going back and living with those movies over the next few years, I'll watch it again, like just developing that relationship. And it's all built in that first viewing, that first experience that you had. I haven't quite brought myself to rewatch Tenet. Chris Nolan's another, you know, obvious one. I'd be like, oh yeah, love Nolan's films, and saw Tenet, couldn't really parse it, and I know I need to watch it another few times. Yeah. But I will, and I want to. Some people might be turned off by that sort of thing and go, I didn't understand that movie, but I'm like, no, I enjoyed it, and I want to keep engaging and make my own interpretation, but I still need time to build that.
I do the same thing, and I'll only have one more question for you in the minute, but I have this is a moment to make a confession, because we're recording this in the second half of June of 2023, and I have already seen one film twice this last week. The first time there were just two other people in the auditorium, the second time I was the only one, and I'm down, and I'm going to see it again tonight, quite late. This is all like 9:30 in the evening, when most normal people are in bed, and this is surprisingly, and it's because I wouldn't call myself a Take That fan, but you know that The Greatest Day, the film that's based on the Take That sort of oeuvre, and I know some people have said they would never watch that, but they go off and watch Thunderbirds, you know, or whatever, Transformers or Spider-Man. So I went to see this thinking, well, I watch everything. And I don't always get emotional. I enjoy film, and I find films can be overpowering. But you actually feel emotional, because it was partly set in 1993, and then you've got the modern day versions of the women who sort of grew up, and sort of like that. There's this band that sort of is there all the way through their life, and then there's a poignant scene where you've got the modern day versions of these girls, or now women in their 40s, having a conversation with their 1993 selves. And for me, you're doing all the stuff on nostalgia, something connected. And I thought, I'm watching this film in a large auditorium. And the staff were like saying to me, "You're interested that you're going to see this, because it's not, hasn't really taken off." So I'm always having this, I'm not going to say numinous experience, but the very the closest I would get to a transcendental experience. And I'm sort of watching this sort of experience of, you know, I know where I was in 1993. And I see this, and the sort of, how have we changed on over the years? And I'm doing it on my own in a solitary sense. And people say, "Oh, it's a bit like Mamma Mia," but Mamma Mia had, you know, a packed screening. So I want to see it again, because I want to sort of almost try to navigate that. There's something that I want to share with people, but often people's reaction is, "Oh, why would you want to go and watch that?" And I think, yeah, but it's that or Transformers, and I'm sorry. You know, sort of there's a point where we have to, you know, cultivate our own niche.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I've got one more question for you, I always finish my interviews, which is to ask whether you would consider yourself, Chris, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
It's back. I think it would have to be back. Not so much because I think, oh yes, definitely looking back, but I don't really do much in the way of forward. Like, yes, obviously I've made various career steps, I've had plans and stuff, but I do find it quite difficult to place myself, you know, a few years in the future. Where do I want to be? What are my hopes and dreams? Life's quite reactive, you know. I do keep moving forward, but so in that sense, not necessarily because I'm like, oh yeah, I'm always looking back and thinking about it, but I know I certainly don't do very much of the thinking to the future. Who knows why that might be.
Well, and often, of course, we're all navigating all of these things at the same time. And I think, you know, I always think in terms of nostalgia, that it's the vantage point, you know, where we are now, that often frames the way and the reasons for our looking back.
Yeah, the way in which you'll interpret that and, you know, think about the same thing now and think about it again 5 years from now, and you'll interpret the impact of certain things differently, and you'll build them into your narrative in a different way.
Yeah, I absolutely. And that was my way of trying to deal with this as an academic project, that actually saying that nostalgia is as much about the present and the future as it is the past, because it's just the lens to which we see things. But Chris, I mean, fantastic. I mean, that was a wonderful journey, you know, in order to see where you come from, where you're going, and all the wonderful, really wonderful things that you've been doing and continue to do. So thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you very much, Chris.